Good morning and welcome to Food Conversations. We've started a little late because we had some technical difficulties bringing in our guests today, but this is indeed Food Conversations, the program about food in all its aspects, from planting seeds to eating, with a special emphasis on establishing food sovereignty in the Shoe Swap. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the Shoe Swap. Community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. This morning we have two very special guests. We have two people who have put farming into the lexicon of the Shoe Swap in a very special way. They are Brian McIsaac and Rebecca Neen, the owners and operators of Leftfield Farm and Cranegales. If you've heard the phrase backhand of God, you know that that's not a method of crowd control. That's a very special beer that is produced by Cranock Ales and is now available from restaurants and other vendors around the community because it's very delicious. So, good morning, Rebecca and Brian.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Tis a pleasure to speak with you. That is what it is. I am going to ask Brian and Rebecca to tell us some of their stories today about how they got to the farm and the brewery. And then next week, we'll have an extended conversation about the farm and how it fits into the agricultural scene and, in fact, the global scene of producing food, so that you can understand the special nature of their operation and production. So let's start with some of the things that happen to people early in life, like being born and the impact it has on the world. So Brian, you were born in Vancouver, but you had a very distinctive sort of cultural identity surrounding you when you were born. Why don't you talk about a little bit, your mom, your dad, the cultural matrix into which you were born?
Well, I'd say a really good position to start, or place to start there, or the although I was born in Vancouver, I feel that I've grown up in Ireland. I've spent quite a bit of time there, living and working in the Irish community, in political circles and Irish Republican circles, and specifically, and a lot of the activities that took place in Ireland is what I think has contributed to the makeup of my identity.
Would it be fair to say that you feel culturally Irish?
Yeah, you know, and I've been adopted as well. It's not just how I feel, but through the amount of work that I've done on cultural activism, be it everything from politics to the language and everything in between, I'd say that I have that worldview for sure.
And it led you to actually cross the Atlantic in your teens, I believe it's somewhere around 1983, and go to Ireland to drink up the culture, you might say, but not necessarily physically. What was that like for you, crossing the Atlantic for the first time to go to Ireland?
Well, I guess I was just out of my teens, but how it was a real stereotypical would be, it was culture shock. I had been exposed to people who are more involved with community than I ever had experienced on this side of the pond, and just the sense of urgency, I guess, is what it is when people you've heard the whole idea that things have to get a lot worse before they can get better, and they were experiencing the what was thrown at the fan immediately when I was there.
So you arrived during the time of what I think people euphemistically call the Troubles.
Yeah, it was pretty hot there, it was a lot of things happening, and when I relay the things that was happening at the time, the British really tried to make the whole conflict situation into a normalization kind of scenario, and it's not normal. It still isn't normal. Irish people there are still, particularly in the north, living in occupied territory, and there's a set of limitations that come with that. You're not a free citizen, and you're a second-class citizen if you're not a loyalist or a unionist or consider yourself British. You are definitely 2.5 times unlikely to get a job, and you are subject to criminalization for the smallest kind of act or made-up act, just to make sure that you could be controlled by having a criminal record, so your travel is restricted, etc.
So you were exposed to a lot of turmoil and behavior that challenged the sort of norms in that society, and that sensitized you. It's interesting, when we were talking before the interview today, you pointed out that Ireland was England's first colony 1,000 years, or, well, 500 years at least, before the major shift towards colonization around the world took place. But Ireland was that one country that became a colony, very similar to the experience of this continent when settlers arrived and started to colonize this country. That was happening in Ireland with shortly after the Norman invasion.
Yeah, because that Norman invasion as well had to do with, I guess the Normans tried to conquer, but they became assimilated, really. And then the only successful type plantations that happened was during Queen Elizabeth's time. And she did the almost textbook, she started the textbook on what had happened with different colonies around the world, and had the plantations there of Presbyterian and Protestant settlers from Scotland, mostly, but some in England, that got there and offered them an advantage to the native population that was there. And then, of course, that were repeated centuries later in Canada.
So what we're talking about is an origin for you of a narrative around colonization and exploitation that obviously shaped your perspective on the world. Rebecca, your origins were a little more tranquil at the political level, born in Toronto to a family that was quite secure, obviously a more peaceful part of the world. And when you were three, your parents moved to Nova Scotia to start a sheep farm, but your parents themselves were interesting. Talk about your parents and how the kind of perspective they brought to what they were doing at that time, moving to Nova Scotia and starting up a farm, brand new farm that they had no experience with.
Yeah, it was sort of a typical naive urbanite thing to do in that sense. But my parents, Brewster and Kathleen Neen, come from different political backgrounds, but were at that point very much involved in social action, in learning to rebuild community. They were actually part of a couple of cooperatives, collective ventures in Toronto as well.
And your father was had studied theology, Protestant theology, and your mother was Jewish. They were coming from another set of divides, but obviously they did well together.
Yes, well, there was a little bit of friction involved in that not getting together. The parents on either side were slightly shocked, but they managed to deal. But Brewster's theology actually has been really important to his understanding of social justice.
Why don't you describe his thesis? Because I think that is the thesis he did at college, because I think that really clarifies what you just said.
Yeah, it does. His thesis was actually on the sugar industry. So it was an examination, therefore, of colonization, of slavery, of global capital before the term global capital had been invented. And it was also a discussion of the way that corporations can influence and control the entire food system. So it was really the very beginnings of the concept of food systems analysis.
Hmm.
And that is basically the central theme of both Brewster and Kathleen's work for the next, 60 years.
So what happened was there's a certain parallel between your life and Brian. You went to the culture of Ireland and the country of Ireland to learn about what was going on that was so important for your sort of cultural heritage. And your family, Rebecca, went on a similar journey. It was shorter and it was within the country, but it was a journey into an area they had no previous experience in, and that was farming and sheep farming.
Yeah, that's right. So they basically left Toronto because they decided that it was really important for them, in order to understand the food system, to look at it from a totally different perspective. Until this point, their perspective was that of a consumer, an eater. And they decided they wanted to, if you want to really understand the food system, look at it from the bottom up, not the, as it were, top down. And so that was farming. So they sold their house in Toronto, and with the proceeds of that, bought 180 acres in Nova Scotia. It was an existing farm, so basically they arrived, discovered that, oh, there's cows here, we need to feed them. Apparently what you do is make hay, we'll start trying to use this equipment, and all of a sudden they were farming at breakneck speed. It then, over the next few years, turned from a cattle farm into a sheep farm. And their discovery of the politics of around farming and the economy around farming led them to an understanding of the control that the middlemen have in agriculture and in the food system.
So here we have Rebecca on a farm and Brian in Ireland. Brian, you didn't just visit Ireland. You also visited other communities that shared some Celtic origins and cultures, such as the Basque community in northern Spain. You did some peregrination, wandering around the continent. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, we had when I was staying in Belfast, we had a bit of a cultural exchange with other separatist movements, although I don't know if you can call the fight for reunification of Ireland separatist movement per se. Although they wanted to separate from the English Empire, British Empire, and then of course the Basque country is very much wanting to maintain their culture away from the Castilian efforts of the Spanish, and so we had a lot in common with those guys. Although, as I was speaking to you yesterday and it told you there was a language barrier, of course, because Spanish is their second language in the Basque country, and Basque, of course, is the primary origin. So I had a hard time putting that together. But they made a real effort to learn a little bit of the Gaelic as well. And, of course, they're quite good at surfing all the different languages. But I should say, too, that it's not a Celtic nation, but it's a pre-Indo-European language. It doesn't
Indeed.
Really bear any resemblance to anything that is in Europe, except for maybe Estonia.
So you were meeting people who, while embedded in sort of a dominant culture, were different, had different cultural roots, different backgrounds. And that ties in a little bit to what you were doing back in Canada when your mom was working with individuals who were mentally disabled in some fashion. And you joined in that work as well. So you were seeing within the Canadian community people who were also to some degree marginalized or separated off from the mainstream. What was that like working with your mom and seeing her values of inclusiveness surrounding you?
Well, that was a real bonus that she was working for the Burnaby Association for the Mentally Handicapped in the Lower Mainland Services Society, and they worked with group homes, and it was a real way of awakening empathetic kind of responses and how we view people who are different. And then it's funny how people with that view different cultures and different races as they denigrate them all the time, but they don't really have the same issue with people who are mentally challenged and what have you. This is, but they're different people, and we go ahead and celebrate what people who have limited skills as far as what we think about as being, mainstream society. We have no problem helping out the Down syndrome people and then we don't denigrate them. We just say, well, they're different people and we should celebrate their strengths.
In part, that may reflect the fact that people with mental disabilities do not pose, if you like, a political challenge. They don't stand up and say, we want you to run society a bit differently. And so it's a power issue, I suspect, that people with Down syndrome and other mental challenges don't challenge the structure, if you like, because they're not in a position to be able to do that.
They're functional within a particular system, and they're more satisfied, and they have less Machiavellian tendencies than a lot of us do.
Yes, Machiavelli did not write about people with Down syndrome. He had a very different perspective. So here's you, Rebecca, on a farm, growing up. What do you remember about being on the farm, the actual physical experience of being on the farm? Being on a farm is a lot of physical work. There's a lot of get up in the morning and do stuff kind of situations. What do you recall about that?
Oh, lots. I mean, I was there from age 3 to 16, so it was pretty much the most important period of my life in that sense. Both my brother and myself were full participants in the farm, whether that was the garden or livestock management. We did 4-H. We were fully involved. So we maintained our own flocks within the main flock. We participated in everything, whether it was, you know, feeding animals all year round, taking care of the lambing, or bringing animals to slaughter, helping out with slaughter. The sheep producers cooperative, called Northumberland, which was founded by my parents and among a group of sheep farmers, actually basically helped farmers organize from their flock through the whole slaughter process and bringing animals to market. So a lot of my experience on the farm was straight up farming. You know, we were farmers, all of us.
Yes.
But the other piece of that was the constant dinner table conversations, the endless phone calls. I really pity the people who shared our party line. It must have been brutal, because we did so much organizing by phone. And I just remember huge, long conversations, whether it was the Sheep Producers Association or my mom with her women's groups, starting the Transition House and Women's Helpline.
Women's Shelter long before they were widespread around the communities.
Yeah. And I remember a lot of conversations around which cops you could trust and which ones were going to be a problem, which ones you could never tell where the Transition House was, and the only one guy on the force. There was only one that we could actually trust with the location.
My goodness. When you think of what's happening with Transition Houses today and look back at how absolutely horrendous it was to get proper support for women who were trying to get out of a difficult relationship, it's clear that we've come a long way, but we still have a lot further to go. So you were actually, I was thinking of the phrase, being living on a farm with benefits. And the benefits were that the family discussions were not just about the weather and the price of wool or sheep or mutton, but also about why you were doing what you're doing. Very, very much like what you were talking about, Brian, examining the way people were treated, both at the political level and also at the social level with the work that you did with your mom, kind of seeing that society had lots of different parts and the parts didn't always get along well together, but they needed to get along well together if things were going to go properly. One of the things you mentioned to me was that the IRA was saying things about women's rights. But what they were saying at the time when you were there was, we'll address women's rights after the revolution. What happened when they said that? What did the women in affiliated with the IRA say about that?
Well, it's interesting because it was a very small minority of people that's coming to a realization that they're a revolutionary movement. It's not limited on whose rights and agendas get addressed, but because Republicanism is, when I was there, they really started blossom into that whole notion of vote inclusivity. Mm. And so women's place within the struggle has always been really important. It just had to be voiced that was an important thing that we had to pursue at the same time. And it's easier to work with a whole wide range of peoples and genders than it is trying to ghettoize your particular struggle. You want to make sure that you are very inclusive.
I think actually, Warren, too, the Irish Republican struggle has always had strong women at its core.
Mm-hmm.
Cumann na Ban, the women's wing, was actually founded alongside the earliest versions of the Republican Brotherhood and what became the armed struggle.
In 1914.
So
indeed,
they were already, and Ireland don't, you know, it might look like a patriarchy on one level, but it's run by the women.
Well, your family might have looked like a patriarchy too, but I think Kathleen, your mother, had a lot to say about how things would be conducted. And that
you're absolutely right, Warren. I mean, my dad is sort of a patriarch by nature and a feminist by politics, and was constantly being challenged and challenging himself to listen to women and to change that structure. Was, you know, politically aware enough to recognize that while the women were in the kitchen making tea, their conversation was actually about things that held the community together. And that was a lesson that my mom talked about a lot as well later on, saying, you know, well, I always wanted to be in the living room where the men were, you know, having coffee and discussing the politics, and the women were in the kitchen feeding people and making sure that everybody was actually taken care of in the community. And that both of those pieces were really critical to a political endeavor. And it was when they got put together, and so the caretaking and the revolution were both happening in the same room, that's when strength started to happen.
Indeed.
I'd say too, there's another aspect of it, because we were talking about solidarity movements and just touch on the Basque, but when the Republican movement really excelled at when they were working with other struggles, and particularly in FMLN and the Nicaraguan Sandinistas, the women's portion of those particular revolutionary struggles is really, really huge. And when we work in solidarity with other movements, we really find that the women's strength is at the core of what's happening in a lot of these struggles. And whether certain struggles choose to look at that and recognize it is something that should always be presented in a positive light, for sure.
The phrase that people often use these days about issues that we're facing is that it's all hands on deck. And an implication in that phrase is that all hands have a role to play, and it's a respectable role. And I think that's what we're sort of moving into discussing. Rebecca, in your own family, at a practical level, that meant combining Jewish traditions with Protestant Christian traditions. And you observed the high holidays, the Jewish high holidays, and you also went to, you know, Sunday school. Tell me what happened when you colored Jesus in Sunday school.
Well, it was actually coincidental with another thing that was happening at the same time on the other side of the wall in the main part of the church. So in the main part of the church, the pastor was actually talking about Canadian politics, international politics, and the fight. At that point, it was Vietnam. Mm. And was trying to generate support for it. And my father got up and said, look, first of all, that has no place in the pulpit. And secondly, you're engaging in really bad theology.
Your father had a tendency to do that, I understand.
Yes. Well, it wasn't the first church we'd gotten kicked out of for the same reason. He really hates bad theology. And bad theology is essentially dominant, patriarchal theology, as opposed to liberation theology, which is based on the idea of social justice. So he was standing up on the other side of the wall explaining that this was bad theology, and I was in Sunday school attempting to color Jesus brown, because as a Jew, I was quite aware of where Jesus actually was born and that he was not going to be pink. And that was, so both of those were happening at the same time, and then they got hustled out of the main hall and came, and we got hustled out of Sunday school, and yeah. So there we are.
I have this image on one side of the wall of a patriarch challenging patriarchy, and then the other side of the wall, a child coloring Jesus the way he would have actually been, and both of you finding yourselves unacceptable in that particular context. Obviously, that didn't hold you folks back and your family back. And in fact, your education at home was quite expansive and quite detailed, you might say, and it compared very favorably to what you were experiencing in the actual school system.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, the maritime school system was at that point pretty sad. Just poor quality, overcrowded, bad teaching, inadequate materials, the whole gamut. So what we learned at home, both in terms of practical skills by farming and observation of the natural world. And I think really importantly in that is, when I'm saying observation, I'm talking about a very intimate relationship with the land.
With Brian gradually expanding and increasing the magnitude of your engagement with Irish culture, but also with global culture and cultures, learning a little Irish, a little conversational Irish with a scholarship. And there's Rebecca, and I'm presenting this way because the two of you were wending your way towards each other through these different worlds that you were growing up and learning about. But the common theme seems to be the issue of values and looking beyond just the material processes that you're involved in. Brian, you went to, after school, you went to college in North Vancouver, and there you studied things that really amplified at an intellectual level many things that you're involved in. You studied communications, you studied political science, but you also studied fine arts, and you were engaged in music and studying music theory. That mix shaped you in many ways. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, I think it makes me go towards the creativity side and inspiring people, and I think that is reflective in the way that we try to get people to change for the positive. I'd like to say that a lot of, especially in the environmental movement, there's a lot of trying to change people by fear, and show them what's wrong with the world and all the disasters that we're heading towards. And although that's important to know, some of the things, some of the misbehavior that humans have been involved in, we also think that, Daniel Ortega used to say, that beyond the revolution, we have to have something to go towards. And so if we start there, we start showing by example and inspiration on how to actually change people in a positive way, and that change is accelerated. And instead of shoving people into despair the way the politics of fear works, I think we're more successful on the positive side. And so those creativity things, looking back upon it, those studies and everything, with the communications and linked with the arts, it really just gelled together on how to actually communicate certain ideas to people and making them come on side because, hey, I want to be in that good story. I want to hear good stories, and I want to, and that aren't full of fluff, but actually solid, stronger stories, I would say, than the doom and gloom and the ghoulness that we get exposed to in regular news cycles.
Yes, and I think that is an important point, and you can see the creative arts playing a major role in amplifying messages that would otherwise not just be difficult to swallow, but also painful. It's sort of a spoon, you know, they say a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down. And at the cultural level, I think that's also true. For your part, Rebecca, you left the school system and were suddenly immersed in university. And that changed things for you as well. How did that change you?
Oh, well, having people of my own age that I could actually talk politics with was one of the most exciting things that's ever happened, or had ever happened up till then.
Yes. Besides your parents, where there was a lot of conversations, but you were the child, not the equal, the peer.
Exactly. Although I will say that my parents were incredibly respectful of both myself and my brother and the way that they spoke to us and allowed our opinions to matter. And that, I think, really prepared both of us for the kind of work that we're doing now. So I wound up studying political science and theater, and thought, I actually thought that theater was where I was going to be. Discovered community theater, which is a political theater, which is essentially workshop, community-based productions that address social and political issues of the day and within the community as a means of change.
You had mentioned you're involved with theater, and I recall a theater group from Quebec called Théâtre Passe-Muraille.
Yeah.
That was a group that did exactly what you're describing. And so you were involved in work like that where you went into community, you embedded yourselves for a while, you found out all the gossip and a few of the scandals, and then you put on a play to show them to people so they could see themselves and see themselves as political and cultural groupings.
Yeah, and some of that is observational, but some of it is actually workshopping within the community itself. So the voices of the community and often members of the community are actually full participants in the production.
Yes, indeed.
So it's also a means of amplifying people's actual voices, not enacting them for them, but helping people to raise their own voices. So yes, Théâtre Passe-Muraille, also Headlines Theatre out of Toronto. There was work being done on the West Coast with Bob Boffin and a couple of other groups. And that all, there's not a lot being done on that now, but that kind of work has really informed the way that we try to approach activism in terms of both the attractiveness of spectacle and the value that that entertainment can create for people. And you see it now in what Caravan Theatre does.
Sure.
They use their beautiful work to create thinking, to get people thinking about issues.
And all along, while you were at university and engaged in community theater, your father, Brewster Neen, was becoming an accomplished and recognized writer, producing a monthly journal called The Ram's Horn. The Ram's Horn referring to somebody blowing the ram's horn and the walls of Jericho falling down, meaning social change happens when you speak up. Tell us a little bit about what it was like to have that. That was your home scenario, your dad writing music, his journal, and your mom involved in community activities. So you had kind of a continuous exposure to thinking about what you were doing.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, the discussions around the dinner table were pretty much always about politics, about structures that needed to be dealt with, how we were going to do it, various different methods of doing that. That conversation has been part of my life as long as I've lived. One of the things about Brewster and Kathleen is that they are both relentless and creative. So when you're thinking about something, you follow it through, you do the research, you really try to dig into it as deeply as possible, look at it from as many perspectives as possible, discuss it ad nauseum, but then come up with a way of presenting it that is engaging.
So it's a complete cycle from inspiration to exploring ideas and gathering data and then producing some kind of coherent statement and then presenting it to the world.
Yeah, and I mean one of the ways that is also expressed. I mean, Brewster's written seven books about the food system, starting with From Land to Mouth, through Farmageddon, and through a book on Cargill called The Invisible Giant, which is a discussion using the examination of Cargill, which was at that point a grain trading company and now has its fingers in a whole lot more pies.
Indeed.
But was one of the first companies to really engage in vertical integration. And so he actually got access to a lot of people within Cargill because they understood that he was actually going to accurately represent what Cargill was doing.
Yes.
And what they were doing. He wasn't there to defame them. He was there to show exactly what they were doing. That process resulted in a very cogent analysis of the entire food system using Cargill as a lens. But people still trusted him within the industry because they knew that he wasn't lying when he said things about them.
Yes, he approached them with a certain degree of honesty and transparency that they could respect.
Absolutely, which also, of course, means that the analysis that he came up with is that much more valid.
I recall reading both those books. I have both of those. And the book about Cargill points out that the company was just another mid-sized food distribution company, a family business, which it apparently still is. But it got its start when the Americans won the Second World War in the Pacific and imposed a whole range of structures on the Japanese people and culture. And one of them was to import food from America, including wheat and dairy products, which were completely foreign to Japanese diet, and became enlarged considerably because of its support from the American government, which continued and continues to this day. That's where they got their big start.
Yeah, that's true.
So here we have, you're at college, you're learning things, and an unexpected consequence of that was that you and your brother were not working on the farm. And that created a sort of a dilemma, because do you expand and hire farm workers, or do you do something else? Because the family unit was the basis for the farm. Just describe that kind of process, what the changes it led to.
Sure. It's a good example of what happens all the time in farms across North America. The structure of the farm, the economy of that farm was based on four people. At that point, all of us pretty much adults and certainly able to work a full 10-hour day.
Sure.
We needed all of us on deck, as it were, to make the farm work. With all four of us on deck and occasionally some other people helping out, we could make that unit function, and we were fine. It worked. It worked really well. But when two of us buggered off in search of what we are pleased to call higher education, the unit was no longer economically viable. In order to function, you needed four full people. But we weren't paid. We weren't paid hourly wages. We had a beautiful living. We weren't lacking, but we weren't earning a ton of money.
Sure.
But if you're going to hire people, you need to actually have cash.
Indeed.
Real money. Well, or the fiction that we like to call money. Anyway, that's another discussion.
Yeah.
but so in order to actually have cash to hire people, the firm unit had to grow. It had to expand in order to create that the economy of scale that would allow more actual money to be changing hands.
Drifting into neoliberal economics, in other words.
Well, yeah, and drifting into more industrial agriculture. So one of the things that, you know, there was a long series of discussions trying to say, well, what does the land do? How do we approach the land that we have available to us in order to make that happen? And the increase in stocking density, the change in the way that the farm would have to be run would mean environmental degradation. There's no way to do what we were doing on the rocky soil of that area of Nova Scotia without causing environmental destruction.
The result of you leaving, going to university, and the discussions took place as a result of what would happen with the farm, with the two children, now adults, working on it for a number of years. The result of that was that you sold the farm and moved back to Toronto. And now, in the meantime, Brian, you were back in Canada in the early 90s, more or less on an ongoing basis, and you were starting to work because you had already, while you were at college, been sought out by somebody who wanted to have you work in the downtown east side. Maybe you could talk about how that transition, like Rebecca's transition, was a significant one and eventually led to the two of you meeting each other. Anyway, Brian, what was it like? You moved out into this project. What was the project like?
Well, it certainly gelled a lot of things where my vocation matched my activism. So I would actually be hands-on working for community and those. There was a pilot project called the Portland Hotel Society, which was set up to house the hardest of the hard to house people, and basically the premise was that you would take people who would not be usually houseable because they would get evicted for doing vandalism to their own particular abode. And anything short of arson or murder, we wouldn't kick people out of the Portland Hotel Society. And so we were working there, and I had multiple tasks there, everything from social work to security to janitorial, and a bit of a pharmaceutical dispenser for untested psychotropic drugs. So that was a bit of an issue for me. But
these were drugs that were actually prescribed, as opposed to
right.
street drugs.
And it was the society was there to stable out people instead of having them kicked out and living on the street.
Right.
And not having them in a stable environment, taking medication that could help them out in their struggles and keep them from the sharks that were coming into the area and taking advantage of the people. So we made sure that people had a safe place to be. And so that really said, well, this is exactly what I'm doing politically. And it's just that instead of on a national, very much hands-on community-based work.
These were also the days when institutional mental health settings were being shut down. Essendale, which was a major setting out towards sort of Burnaby Coquitlam, was in the process of being emptied of its patients because there was a notion that you could administer drugs to people to help them deal with a problem with taking drugs often. Whether that is a viable hypothesis is being much more seriously questioned now than it was then, but certainly at that time it was viewed as a benefit to society. You were working with the people in direct terms at that time, and I suspect saw that care and attention to detail with your care working with these people probably was the thing that you could offer them that was most important.
Well, it's a twin kind of philosophy that was happening at the time. They were closing institutions. A lot of it was altruistically motivated, but
indeed,
you can't forget too that a lot of it was commerce also based as well. People thought they could actually get away with throwing these people in the lot with the rest of society and not pay for having these institutions that were open, and they could just get all the layperson to look after the different peoples. And so I think it's turned out for the better in some ways. There's people being part and parcel of the larger community, which I think is really important, how to view people instead of sticking them somewhere and warehousing them and give them meaningless things to occupy their time with.
Sure. So you were working in Vancouver, and after university, Rebecca, you ended up in Vancouver.
Roughly, yeah, that's right.
Roughly when did you arrive in Vancouver?
1991,
okay.
Which was one of the early periods or early-ish periods of gentrification of the East Side. So this coincided with, you know, this influx of people coming out of those institutions and having nowhere to go except living in the downtown East Side. We were a little bit further east. When I arrived in Vancouver, a friend found me a spot to live, which was actually at a series of squatted homes.
The Francis Street Squats.
Yes. Yes. Now of infamy. It was a great example of gentrification. Some of the houses had absolutely nothing wrong with them, but they were slated to be torn down because the landowner wanted to put in a large building of condominiums that were going to be significantly higher priced and that did not fit with that single home heritage community that had been there for generations and generations.
And you, coming from a background of social activism, became involved in that struggle to try and protect the building from mindless destruction by a developer. And therefore, you met the police, as you said, about the police you knew in Nova Scotia. There were some that you could trust, some that you couldn't. It made you aware of the fact that the police, the policing end of the social matrix was not always reliable, but then there were some who were. And Brian, you were working in the downtown East Side this time as well. And by a variety of coincidences, the two of you came across one another. Do you, I'll ask each of you separately, please don't listen to each other's answers. What was your first awareness of Brian's presence, Rebecca?
Well, I met him at the squats, but there was a lot of stuff going on, so I wasn't as aware of him at that point, except as another on-site activist. But I kept seeing him around the community, and there was this fascinating, gorgeous man covered in incredible artwork. So I kind of stalked him for a while, kept following around, figuring out where he hung out, and he kept popping up at the same demonstrations and political meetings and all of that kind of stuff. So, so I kept my eye on him.
Well, that's important. So Brian, what do you recall first about Rebecca?
Well, it's interesting that she was using the word stalking, because definitely I was doing the same kind of things, and probably and she didn't see me sometimes because I was dressed up in kind of what I recall too as nerd wear, nondescript kind of things, because I was taking part in actions, and of course I couldn't be viewed as myself, the artistically adorned guy. So I actually followed her, and she didn't know she was being followed sometimes.
We're coming to perilously close to the end of the program, so I want to move ahead a little bit, and I'm going to just there was an encounter. Is encountering a coffee shop and a Women's Day March. And the Women's Day March, Rebecca, you saw Brian, you thought he was just a bunch of men handing out socialist tracts, and you went over to him to give him hell, and what happened?
Well, it turned out, yeah, we were objecting to the fact that there were a lot of men handing out stuff at the Women's March, and why weren't they doing something better with their time, and what the hell was this anyway, they didn't belong there. Went over after I saw him, and I was very disappointed. It's like, oh my God, I like this guy. And discovered that, in fact, the Irish Solidarity Committee was the group that he was with. All of the women were already in the march with their own banner, not very far away from me. And so his job was to hand out leaflets for a feminist Irish speaker who was coming up shortly at the coffee shop that I volunteered at. So I had to sort of apologize for yelling at him.
Well, there you are. a fine start. On the other hand, in a restaurant that both of you used to hang out in, you went in with a book called Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. You put it out so Brian could see it, and Brian saw it. And what did you do, Brian?
Well, basically, I was there. Basically, my friend and me used to loan out money to people and collect at that one restaurant. And so there was times there that we'd be there. Rebecca spied, and I had it there. And then I met her by actually seeing the book that she was reading. And I said, oh, that's a beautiful book. Exactly right up my alley, because I've just gotten back from Belfast. And there was some murals done by the American Indian Movement on Leonard Peltier. And so it was fresh in my mind. I just read the book as well. And so we basically, her trap line worked.
Yep. We're going to wind things down now, but I just wanted for listeners to tell them that, in fact, the relationship flourished and continues to this day. And a little while later, your parents, Rebecca, brought the land on which your current operations are based, Leftfield Farm and Cranock Ales, and we're going to spend our time on the next show talking about how that progressed and what kind of a farming and agricultural operation it is. I want to thank you both, Rebecca and Brian, for being with us today, and I look forward to talking to you next week. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much. We look forward to next time.